I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. When Pablo Neruda was awarded the 1971 Nobel Prize for Literature, the presenter jokingly complained that, to sum up, Neruda is like catching a condor in a butterfly net. The Chilean poet wrote some of the sweetest love poems of the last century, and some of its harshest political attacks. He traveled, he told stories, he was a diplomat, a senator, a communist, but always a poet.
Todos estos señores estaban dentro cuando ella entró completamente desnuda. Ellos habían bebido y comenzaron a escupirla. Ella no entendía nada, recién salía del río. Era una sirena que se había extraviado. Los insultos corrían sobre su carne lisa. La inmundicia cubrió sus pechos de oro. Ella no sabía llorar, por eso no lloraba. No sabía vestirse, por eso no se vestía.
Neruda explained himself when he accepted his Nobel Prize. He said, and I'm quoting him here, "We must pass through solitude and difficulty, isolation and silence, in order to reach forth to the enchanted place where we can dance our clumsy dance and sing our sorrowful song. But in this dance, or in this song, there are fulfilled the most ancient rites of our conscience in the awareness of being human and of believing in a common destiny." Connection listeners, can a poet be both a harsh political critic and a lover's guide? Some say Neruda tainted himself in alliances with Stalin and Castro, and others consider him the poet laureate of the entire South American continent. So, what is Pablo Neruda to you? Our number's 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. With me today is Ilan Stavins. He is a professor of Latin American and Latino culture at Amherst College. He's the author of a number of books, including On Borrowed Words, a Memoir of Language, which he talked about here on the program, and Spanglish, the Making of a New American Language. He's back today to discuss a new anthology, his. It's called The Poetry of Pablo Neruda. Welcome back to the program, Ilan. Nice to
Thank
have you
very
here.
Much. It's a pleasure.
You've never met the poet himself. So when you hear him read his poetry, does he give you anything that you don't get when you're reading it yourself?
He surely does. I am of a generation that came of age when Neruda was already an old sage. He died in 1973 when I was in my teens. And to hear his voice is to hear today the voice of a prophet and also of a priest and of a belligerent artist who never stopped telling truth to power. For a while in Latin America, there was this sense that the time for Pablo Neruda had come and gone, that activist poetry was no longer in use. But I think, fortunately, we've returned to a time when politics and poetry are married.
Now, when you were a kid in Mexico, was it true you could really pick up girls using a line from a Pablo Neruda poem?
But I wasn't the only one. We were always memorize and use his words because we knew that they were better than ours.
Can we go to one of his love poems here? This one is number 14 in the 20 love poems. I don't know whether or not in your study of the man, you separate them and say, well, this is this and this is this, or do you choose to look at the love poems, these 20, which he wrote, gosh, when he was what?
Barely 20.
Yeah.
Himself, a very young man, infatuated with the idea of love. In this collection, the first one that brought him a name and a reputation, the astonishing element is that he doesn't talk about the lover, but about love. The lover is only an excuse for him to experience this erotic element of that makes him palpitate and makes him feel closer to nature and to the cosmos in general. Those early poems remain some of the most popular, not only in Latin America. Probably they are the most translated poems of Neruda into any language. And many of us Latin Americans would memorize them in school, as we said earlier. And this particular one, poem 14, is a sweet, emblematic poem, the last line of which many listeners, I guess, will recognize. It is a wonderful translation by W.S. Merwin, who stands as one of the highest caliber translators of Neruda. Every day you play with the light of the universe. Subtle visitor, you arrive in the flower and in the water. You are more than this white head that I hold tightly as a cluster of fruit every day between my hands. You are like nobody since I love you. Let me spread you out among yellow garlands. Who writes your name in letters of smoke among the stars of the south? Oh, let me remember you as you were before you existed. Suddenly, the wind howls and bangs at my shut window. The sky is a net crammed with shadowy fish. Here all the winds let go sooner or later, all of them. The rain takes off her clothes. The birds go by, fleeing. The wind. I can contend only against the power of men. The storm whirls dark leaves and turns loose all the boats that were moored last night to the sky. You're here. Oh, you do not run away. You will answer me to the last cry. Cling to me as though you were frightened. Even so, at one time, a strange shadow ran through your eyes. Now too, little one, you bring me honeysuckle, and even your breasts smell of it. While the sad wind goes slaughtering butterflies, I love you, and my happiness bites the plum of your mouth. How you must have suffered getting accustomed to me, my savage, solitary soul, my name that sends them all running. So many times we have seen the morning star burn, kissing our eyes, and over our heads the gray light unwinds in turning fans. My words rained over you, stroking you. A long time I have loved the sun, mother of pearl of your body. I go so far as to think that you own the universe. I will bring you happy flowers from the mountains, bluebells, dark hazels, the rustic baskets of kisses. I want to do with you what spring does with a cherry tree.
That's the line. I want to do with you what the spring does with the cherry trees. It's a memorable line.
Memorable, and probably the best we can do with it is not to explain it.
Now, you said he was just 20 when these were written, and he was barely into his 30s then when he started to travel. All through his poems, and you've collected some 600 of them here in the book, and I gather that's, what, only maybe a third of those published.
Right? Exactly.
All through the poems, there is that sense of the physical man, of his being aware of his body, of the place of man in the universe. But something happens to him in Spain.
He does.
When he goes to witness the Spanish Civil War. Is that a transformation?
It's a radical transformation, Dick. It's a moment in which Neruda recognizes that he no longer can be a poet of the erotic, of the most intimate, a poet of isolation and in distance. He recognizes himself as a voice of his time and of his people, and recognizes that his words are not only his, but they are words also of those that have no access to them. He becomes a spokesperson for others. And at one point in Spain, and we must remember Spain, the Spanish Civil War, was that moment of intense transformation, not only for Neruda, but for a number of intellectuals the world over, George Orwell and Arthur Koestler, and a number of Latin Americans, along with Neruda, that realized that the powers that clash in a society can have a damaging impact all over. It's not who wins and who loses. In the end, we all lose, and that is exactly what happened to him. He realized that Spain, a country that for most people south of the Rio Grande, it is the colonial center, the empire, the force that has erased our original identity. Spain was his too, and he needed to cry for it, cry for its heart.
I wonder if I can ask you to read then a poem that I know is a favorite of yours. It's called I Explain a Few Things, but, well, it sort of explains itself, I guess, doesn't it?
It does. This is a moment in which Neruda will try to separate the before from what will come, the poet of intimacy from the political poet. And this is an extraordinary translation we work hard on by Galway Kinnell, a wonderful American poet. I explain a few things. You will ask, but where are the lilacs and the metaphysics covered with poppies and the rain that often struck his words, filling them with holes and birds?
Let me tell you what's happening with me. I lived in a barrio of Madrid, with bells, with clocks, with trees. From there you could see the parched face of Castile, like an ocean of leather. My house was called the House of Flowers, because from everywhere geraniums burst. It was a beautiful house, with dogs and children. Raúl, do you remember? Do you remember, Rafael? Federico, do you remember under the ground? Do you remember my house with balconies, where the June light drowned the flowers in your mouth? Brother, brother? Everything was loud voices, salt of goods, crowds of pulsating bread, marketplaces in my barrio of Argüelles, with its statue, like a pale inkwell, set down among the hake. Oil flowed into spoons, a deep throbbing of feet and hands filled the streets, meters, liters, the hard edges of life, heaps of fish, geometry of roofs under a cold sun in which the weather vane grew tired, delirious fine ivory of potatoes, tomatoes, more tomatoes, all the way to the sea. And one morning, it was all burning. And one morning, bonfires sprang out of the earth, devouring humans. And from then on, fire. Gunpowder from then on, and from then on, blood. Bandidos with planes and moors, bandidos with rings and duchesses, bandidos with black friars singing the cross, coming down from the sky to kill children, and in the street the blood of children ran simply like the blood of children. Jackals the jackals would despise, stones the dry trestle would bite on and spit out, vipers the vipers would abominate. Facing you, I have seen the blood of Spain rise up to drown you in a single wave of pride and knives. Traitors, generals, look at my dead house, look at Spain broken. From every house, burning metal comes out instead of flowers. From every crater of Spain comes Spain. From every dead child comes a rifle with eyes. From every crime, bullets are born that one day will find out in you the sight of the heart. You will ask, why doesn't his poetry speak to us of dreams, of leaves, of the great volcanoes of his native land? Come and see the blood in the streets. Come and see the blood in the streets. Come and see the blood in the streets.
I explain a few things. It's a poem by Pablo Neruda. Connection listeners, our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. An amazing contrast between the love poetry and the political poetry of the man. Does he bridge that gap? Does he bridge that gap for you? Can you do both? Could you do both today? Our number is 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR.
Support.
You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. I'm Dick Gordon. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. My guest is Ilan Stavins. He has a new anthology of the poetry of Pablo Neruda. That's the name of it as well. It's the most comprehensive single volume ever published in English. It's got about 600 of Neruda's poems in it. I want to just, if I can, Ilan, go back to a couple of the lines from the poem that you read before the break. There's a fascinating thing that he does as a poet, when he stops just into the beginning of the poem and says, let me tell you what's happening with me. It's like he's a reporter there. He's almost moving out of his garb as a poet, as a literary figure, and saying, you need to pay attention to what I'm saying here.
He does. It seems as if he is chronicling what the many forces that are in his heart. And he wants no curtains, no obstacles. He wants everybody to hear it. I think reporting is the right word. Neruda understood poetry as a way of becoming a witness to his own time, but not only of the external world, of the historical epic forces that would descend on him or would descend on any of us, but on those internal forces that make us human every day, that affect us in our relationship with just passing objects. He was extraordinary in his chants and odes to items that many of us pay little attention to: socks, pencils, onions. This is a poet that would go from singing to Walt Whitman to celebrating the onion.
Let me use the example of what you mentioned here, because there's a poem. I know it's here in front of me somewhere. It's called "I Begin by Invoking Walt Whitman." And I don't want to read the whole thing because I want to get at what it's telling us. But he starts by saying, "Because I love my country, I claim you, essential brother, old Walt Whitman, with your gray hands." But when he gets down to the point of the poem, he's talking about Richard Nixon.
That's right.
I mean, this is a remarkable gulf that he steps across, isn't it?
No doubt. And this is a poem that he wrote later in life when he understood that American foreign policy was a disgrace in his eyes, that Richard Nixon in particular was a villain. But he put together a collection called A Call for the Destruction of Richard Nixon and a Celebration of the Chilean Revolution. And he put down all his aesthetic motifs and decided that he would become a propagandist, so to speak, a man whose poetry would be turned into a weapon. In this particular poem, he invokes Whitman to say, "Come with me, come American people, the one that are represented by Whitman, to attack this politician that is not honoring you and who has become a murderer." And it is quite astounding. It is, I should say also, Dick, a part of Neruda's poetry that many well-educated readers would like not to see. They would prefer to see the epic poet that talks about history, talks about forces, talks about love, but not the poet that uses words as weapons.
Is it because they see him as sullying himself in some way?
And because they believe that his own standards as a poet are lowered in order to make a political or ideological message come across.
I want to read just three or four lines from another poem. It's called "I Wish the Woodcutter Would Wake Up." And this is a Robert Bly translation, is that right? Oh, I Wish the World Would Wake Up, Robert Bly. Okay. And he says, "Come deeper into Missouri, look at the cheese and the flour, the boards aromatic and red as violins, the man moving like a ship among the barley, the blue-black colt just home from a ride smells the odor of bread and alfalfa, bells, poppies, blacksmith shops." And he goes on. And I mean, it's a lyrical, almost love poem about America. So how does he reconcile this love of what is American with his vitriol about what American foreign policy was?
At one point in that particular poem, "I Wish the Woodcutter Would Wake Up," he says, "What we love, we Hispanics, we foreigners, what we love about you, America, is your peace, not your mask. Your warrior's face is not handsome. North America, you are handsome and spacious. You come like a washerwoman from a simple cradle near the river's pail." He wants to go beyond the iron face that we often show through politics and resorts to the common people, the ones that live in the countryside. But interestingly, this poem, and I was discussing it with my students just yesterday, doesn't invoke the American that lives in the city. Instead, goes for the one that lives in the countryside. It's a very 19th century celebration of America, very Walt Whitman-like.
Now, in all his travels, in all the different occupations and guises that he had in his time, he was a diplomat. He spent a long time in the Soviet Union. He was a huge fan of Joseph Stalin.
Right. And
I'm wondering at what point he starts to gather political baggage that's too close to him, that again, like the Nixon diatribes, alienate people who want to know him as a poet.
Absolutely. This is a poet, Neruda, who thrives by making enemies, and his celebration of Stalin would ultimately cost him many friendships. Many Latin American poets of distinction, Octavio Paz, would not want to come close to him because they would claim that when the world already knew about the gulags, when the world already knew about the massacres that Stalin had perpetrated,
and the Ukrainian famine,
Neruda was still oblivious or had turned a blind eye, was still celebrating communism as the option, not realizing that totalitarianism over there is as bad as anywhere else, left or right.
And how do you make sense of this as a student of Neruda? Do you say, look, you just have to come to terms with this man yourself, or do you want to tell us, the readers, that we need to accept all of him, or we need to accept a little bit of him?
It's more the second option that you presented, Dick. I am of the opinion that we all make choices, and our lives are made of accidents in the end. Those choices result in building up a career or a pattern, choices that result in mistakes or in the opposite. Neruda has to be seen as a man that was committed to his time, that would not shy away from making choices. Some of those choices were regrettable, and still he stood by them. I think that it is much more useful to see Neruda as a whole, complete and not fragmented, not only the erotic or the romantic poet, or not only the epic historical one. We will learn much more by seeing the greatest poems come alive, but also by seeing the lesser ones, because that is the poet that ended up coming to us. He produced thousands and thousands of poems. He, in some ways, did not know much about self-censorship. What are we to do? Are we to censor the poems that are of less quality? No, I think we should appreciate them as a response to the particular stimuli that he had. We all, in the end, do the same.
How did he ever find the time? Because if he was all these other things, a diplomat and a senator and a representative of his country in cultural matters and traveling all the time and in living in all these different places, it's almost that the poetry that you went through in pulling this anthology together must have appeared more like bits and pieces of a diary, something that he would use to track his own life and time in the last century.
How did he find time? I would say that probably for him, poetry was like breathing. It did not necessarily entail activating a mechanism and it would become work. It was automatic. One of the qualities of Neruda's poetry is the fact that it comes to us as if dictated by a higher force, and he is only the secretary. He's only the scribe that will deliver it. I find the poetry high and low incredibly stimulating intellectually and incredibly moving. I find myself at night, sometimes when I can't sleep, reading out loud a poem that I just stumbled when opening a book, and realizing that beyond the words, there's a crystalline element in the style, a flowing of the words as if it were a river. And that river has a purifying element in me. Again, I might not necessarily like what the poem is saying, but I like the feeling, the experience of reading it and letting my senses be soaked by those words.
Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. Ilan Stavins is my guest. We're talking about his new anthology of Pablo Neruda's poetry called The Poetry of Pablo Neruda. Let's go to Amherst, Massachusetts, and Bruce is on the line. Now, Bruce, are you a student?
No, my friend of... Soy Padre Bruce, a friend of Professor Stavins.
Hello, hello.
How are you?
Fine, and you?
Welcome to Boston.
Thank you.
The question I have for you is how, using Neruda's poetry as an example, how is the Latin American vision changing the perspective of North America? How is it influencing our culture and maybe transforming our language itself?
A wonderful question. I think that Neruda is, among many other things, a bridge between North and South, a true vessel of communication. This is a man who felt close to the experience of Latinos in the 50s and 60s, way before any Latin American would discover the existence of this community in the United States. He wrote about Chicanos, he wrote about Puerto Ricans, he wrote about Cubans, and he wrote also about North America in a way that was very sympathetic. It is hard to think of a North American writer breaching out in a similar way to the South. The South is often perceived as the land of exoticism and drugs and extremes. And I think that through these poems, he is able to create the sense that we live in a unified continent, that we might have different languages, we might have different idiosyncrasies, but in the end, we are a single unit, North and South, East and West. And it is a veritable lesson, I think, we need to remember and return to.
His collection of poems, Canto General, I think is in many ways an example of the continental vision of the man. I mean, people talk about this as an encyclopedia of Latin America or an atlas. I don't know how you look at it.
Can you imagine a poet deciding that he would take upon himself an entire continent and narrate every single aspect of it, its flora, its fauna, its minerals, the dreams that have made that continent, the politicians, the rapers, the exploiters, but also the woodcutters and the washerwomen, every single aspect of life in the continent, in the Americas, is there, and in a way that it becomes successful. I mean, it's a daunting, even pretentious enterprise, but one that he is able to pull off quite admiringly. And I think that perhaps that is something that needs to be remembered as we ponder the role of poetry in the 21st century. What is a poet's role in society? And what is the poet's connection to history and to present, past, and future? Here is a man that had many, many defects, but he also had lots of courage, and a courage to explain through his eyes, becoming a historian, a reporter, what his surrounding was all about.
1-800-423-8255 to Concord, Massachusetts, and David's with us now. There's a question for you, David. What is the poet's role in society? David, are you there?
I'm here.
Go ahead.
I just wanted to respond to this question about whether the poet can be expected to span the range from being a poetry of nature and eros all the way to being a critic of war. And I think it's an absurd question. As soon as you ask it, you are implicitly assuming that each of the listeners, each of the human beings that exists, has this span. Certainly we should expect the poet, of all people, to be able to span the range of human experience.
And be as persuasive in both extremes, David?
Absolutely. It reminds me of when Martin Luther King was taken to task when he began to criticize our actions in Vietnam, and people said, well, you're a civil rights jockey. You have no business talking about Vietnam. It was absurd.
By all means. And this brings to mind something that Borges, no friend of Neruda, by the way, once said, the legacy of any writer and every writer is the world. You don't have to limit yourself to your particular reality, to your ghetto or to your countryside or to your country. If Shakespeare could write about Denmark and about England and about the Caribbean, why can't we? Why can't a Latin American writer write about Afghanistan or an Afghani writer write about Buenos Aires? And Neruda personifies this. He wrote about Vietnam, he wrote about Cambodia, he wrote about the miseries of Latin American corrupt politicians as well.
David, thanks a lot for your call. 1-800-423-8255 to Louisville, Kentucky now, and Maria's joining us. Hi, Maria.
Hi, Hello. I have a comment and a question. The comment is, before he was talking in the program about how, when did Neruda had time to write, he did travel extensively, but he did travel mainly by boat, by train. He spent months at a time in the middle of the ocean, having nothing else to do, basically. And that's what he did a lot of his writing. And also, I wanted to talk about his daughter. He, in his memories, he doesn't mention at all about having a daughter. He had a daughter who died very young. And he's a bit of a master of denial because he never recognized, when Stalin, when things went wrong with communism, he never, admitted the greatness of Borges, like mentioned. But how about his daughter? Is there any poem that talk about her?
Didn't even write about the breakup of his marriages.
No. And I think the master of denial is a good term. In the end, of course, he's the one who decides what to write about. And we are left to judge and criticize if we want to. To the best of my knowledge, there is no record of that daughter in his poetry. There are records of his love for various women, but not his breakups with them. Maybe this is a poet that decides that that what he will record is what he wants to send to the future in a time capsule, and there are parts he doesn't want to. And censorship, again, comes, self-censorship comes as an important word here. But
is it any less genuine for that? Do you raise an eyebrow when you're gathering his poems and say, oh, come on, Pablo, you could have at least told me something about that?
I have qualms with other writers as well. Octavio Paz also had a daughter whom he never talked to in life and hardly ever wrote about or wrote to. Isaac Bashevis Zinger had a son he didn't recognize. The domestic, the private, is a very difficult realm for any one of us. And should a writer, when writing about everything, really use the word everything to encompass the entire universe? Are there parts that should be left untouched? Probably in terms of feelings and in terms of inner integrity, he needed to leave those ones.
Although he leaves you wondering, if he's not going to write about his own personal life, what can he teach us about love? And yet he does that so beautifully. Our number's 1-800-423-8255. Connection listeners, the poetry of Pablo Neruda this hour on The Connection. I'm Dick Gordon.
Support.
You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. My guest this hour, Ilan Stavins, professor of Latin American and Latino culture at Amherst College and editor of a brand new anthology called The Poetry of Pablo Neruda. And that's what we're talking about this hour, the range of the man and whether or not he can do it all. 1-800-423-8255 is the number to join us, next to Cambridge, Massachusetts. And Richard's joining us. Hi, Richard.
Hi, how are you?
Fine, thanks for calling.
What I like about Neruda as a poet is that he can bridge that gap between the politics and art, and he uses his art as a tool. And you'll find in him, like especially in the canto, you were quoting, I think, the passage from Let the Rail Splitter Awaken, where he'll go out with this litany of a catalog of evils, but then he always seems to pivot toward the heart, where he says, in that part, let none of this come to pass. Let us all just pound the table with love. And I think that's where he has the great power as a poet to grapple with political things that most people would often say turn away from, and really change the heart and make this planet a better place.
Is it the ability to make large political issues like that somehow personal that you mean, Richard?
Personal, but even more human, and it goes right to the heart rather than, say, to the head. Politics and religion often, is heated in the head, but he manages to take that and center it in the heart.
And as you know, Richard, the word heart, corazón, appears frequently in Neruda's work, not only in his titles, but all over, as if he understands perfectly that with the heart we think.
Exactly. I read a an essay from Ginsberg that was using the same argument, and he said basically with Neruda, it came down to this: can you make a soul like Henry Kissinger weep? If you can do that, and Neruda can do that, you know, can you make Kissinger cry? If you can accomplish that with your poetry, then you really can do it. And I think Neruda can do that. And as a poet, that's what I try to do. I often grapple with political issues with poetry, and he's my role model for doing that.
Richard, thank you so much for calling.
Thank you.
Nice to have you with us. You were saying a little bit earlier that at times when you just sort of feel like hearing a bit of poetry, you'll pick it up and read it unbidden. Now, you're, I assume, Ilan, reading it in its original Spanish.
I read it in Spanish, but I also read it in English. I have spent enough time in this country. Almost symmetrically, my life is divided in two, the years that I've spent here and the years that I spent abroad. And I find myself often going to the translations, mostly in English, of Neruda, and there are many that are just supreme.
This was a big deal for you. You had to sort through not just however many thousand poems that you wanted to choose, but then all the translations.
And I wanted the volume to pay tribute to the role of translators as intermediaries. It is thanks to them, to the way they have reinvented or brought us to Neruda, that we're able to have his words. And yes, often we debate the issue of translation as a form of betrayal, that we are not getting the original the way it should be. But the struggle of making a poem of Neruda come alive is daunting. His simplicity in Spanish becomes a deceit, a form of, it's like a mask. It apparently is very simple to bring him into English, but the moment you try, you realize how hard the job is. And some have succeeded astonishingly, others less so. In the volume, there are a couple of moments, more than a couple, perhaps half a dozen, where I decided not to choose as an editor. There were two or three, sometimes four translations that I thought were superb, each of them unique in their own right. And rather than choosing one, I included the four. So the reader has...
What do you call
four.
This, some kind of symphonic anthology?
That's right.
Yeah, I like that.
and you know, in the end, we have only one Neruda in Spanish, but we have many Nerudas in English. And
now you translate the man. So when you pick up the translation by someone else, again, I mean, this is the moment at which translation ceases to become technical and becomes its own art form, because there must be a tendency for you as a translator to say, I would have done it this way, or I would have turned it that way. But at other times to just back off and say, she got it right.
It goes beyond the words. It's getting it right has to do with synthesizing your sensibility as a translator to the sensibility of the author, of the poet, in making the two cultures, the two worldviews come together, the two individuals come together. Sometimes a translator can do it in one poem and not in another. Sometimes a translator will do five or six poems that are a disaster and will never succeed. It's like the lottery.
You, we have a poem. I think this is also a favorite of yours. Your laughter.
Yeah.
Can we just perhaps hear you read the first little bit of the poem in English? And well, let's hear that first, because after that we'll listen to the Spanish.
Take bread away from me, if you wish. Take air away, but do not take from me your laughter. Do not take away the rose, the lance flower that you pluck, the water that suddenly bursts forth in your joy, the sudden wave of silver born in you. My struggle is harsh, and I come back with eyes tired at times from having seen the unchanging earth. But when your laughter enters, it rises to the sky, seeking me, and it opens for me all the doors of life.
Now the Spanish version of the same poem you've chosen to include in the English anthology.
And I should say that the translation is by Donald D. Walsh.
Thank you.
Tu risa. Quítame el pan, si quieres. Quítame el aire, pero no me quites tu risa. No me quites la rosa, la lanza que desgranas, el agua que de pronto estalla en tu alegría, la repentina ola de plata que te nace. Mi lucha es dura, y vuelvo con los ojos cansados, a veces de haber visto la tierra que no cambia. Pero al entrar tu risa, sube al cielo buscándome
y abre para mí todas las puertas de la vida.
Now maybe it's just me and the English language and the romantic languages, but I hear more music in the Spanish version of the same poem.
But it might be, Dick, because it's easier to love in Spanish than in English, or it's easier, I don't know if it's easier to love, it's easier to say I love you in Spanish, at least for me, than it is in English. In this translation, I think the effort is done right, but I feel that one gets the sense that it is a translation. Maybe the goal of a translation is to get the reader to feel that there's nothing in between, that this was the original. Although there are others that believe that a translation should always be stressing the fact that it is a translation, that it is artificial, that you are not touching the original source.
I read a story by a reporter who'd gone to visit the three homes of Pablo Neruda, one in Santiago, one in Valparaiso, and one at Isla Negra. Have I said that right?
Right.
Which was his
retreat.
On the rocky coast. And what struck me about his description of the retreat, he said, is that all the shelves were filled with things, seashells and butterflies pinned up in cages. It taught me a little bit more about Neruda, because he describes the things of life
right
so brilliantly, so consistently, that then to discover that he wanted to surround himself with them as well.
The items of life, not only did he spend his life singing and celebrating them, but, as you say, surrounded himself with them. Not the items that we buy, mm-hmm. not the items
That's
that
right.
we possess, but the items that we often forget, and yet they are always around us. And in that sense, I think Neruda is a poet always in search of a harmony to be established between the individual and his cosmos. It might sound pretentious and overinflated, but this is a man that at one point in his life returns to the ocean and just looks at the colors, looks at, hears the sound, and feels that he is part of that context. He needs to use words to replicate, to describe what he's experiencing. And by finding those words, he encounters some sort of connection, metaphysical connection, physical too, between the self and the universe. It is something that dates back to the 18th, 19th century, perhaps. We today think it might be prosaic, it might be esoteric. But in the end, we're all, no matter how good or bad we write, we are all poets. We're all at one point in need of reconnecting with our environment, and his words serve as a bridge.
He died almost 30 years ago. Not today, but 30 years ago, about 10 days ago.
That's right, on the 20th.
If I got that right. And he died in many ways a poet's death, because though he was sick with cancer, it was just in the weeks after the coup and Salvador Allende was killed, and it broke his heart.
Another September 11, we forget in the U.S. that September 11 had a history before September 11, and the coup took place on that date. And you are absolutely right. He died a poet's death, which is a death out of sadness, the sadness of recognizing that his efforts in life had come to little, and that the forces that he had not want to prevail had become the ones that were surrounding him. Can one really die of sadness? Is that a metaphor? I don't think so. In this particular case, at least, I don't think the metaphor killed him. He himself was overwhelmed with a sense of despair and anxiety, and of course, that let the cancer take over quickly.
Now, you as professor will tell us that if we want to find Neruda, we find him in his poems. I'm wondering if I can get you to turn to Animal of Light as one which, I don't know, it speaks at least somewhat about that passing.
Yeah, this is a poem of the more mature Neruda. He is writing it already in the 70s when he himself is coming to close to his death. And this is a poem about facing your own destiny, recognizing your own fate, and looking for peace. I am in this endless lack of solitude, an animal of light, corralled by his mistakes and by his foliage. The forest is wide. Here, my brother creatures swarm,
back away, or roam around while I retreat accompanied by the escort that time chooses. Waves of the sea, stars of the night. It is small, it is wide, scarce, and it is everything. My eyes, from looking into so many eyes, and my mouth, from so many kisses, from having swallowed the smoke of those trains that vanished, the old merciless stations, and the dust of countless bookshops. The man I am, the mortal, weary of eyes, of kisses, of smoke, of roads, tired of books, thicker than the earth. And today, deep in the forest, in the lost forest, he hears the rustling of the enemy and flees, not from the others, but from himself, from the interminable conversation, from the choir that used to sing with us, and from the meaning of life. Because one moment, because one voice, because one syllable, or the passing of one silence, or the undying sound of the wave, leave me face to face with the truth, and there is nothing left to decipher, nothing more to say. That was all. The doors of the forest are closed, the sun circles opening the leaves, the moon rises like a white fruit, and man suits himself to his destiny.
Ilan Stavins reading from the poetry of Pablo Neruda. Now, you're a young man. Do you remember when he died?
I remember when he died, but I was too young to recognize the power of that death. And Neruda has grown in size for me as I have become closer to him as a reader. And in many ways, I am very thankful to my students for having pushed me to reread Neruda. It was thanks to a student at one point who invited me to read my favorite poem of Neruda in his wedding that I took the trip to read many more and choose one. And this book resulted from that invitation.
Well, your affection for the man is very infectious. It's great to have you in the studio.
Thank you for the invitation.
Ilan Stavins, editor of The Poetry of Pablo Neruda. Connection listeners, you're welcome to continue the conversation. And just a few moments from now, you'll get a chance to listen to Ilan reading more of Pablo Neruda by going to our website. We're at theconnection.org. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.